G'day there, my name's Matt Brann, and right across WA, you're tuned into the Country Hour. I'm just filling in today for Bridget Fitzgerald, which means the Country Hour today is coming to you live from downtown Kununurra. This town is, of course, home to the Ord Irrigation Scheme, which has been in the headlines a bit in this last week, thanks to a report which claimed the Ord had delivered very little returns from a cost of around $2 billion. Do you remember that report? Well, people in Kununurra aren't very happy with that report and are feeling a bit undervalued. And they're now posing some interesting questions about the report and the motives behind it. We'll take a look for ourselves in the second half of this program. I hope you can stick around for that. It is day two of the Australian Grains Industry Conference. We'll be crossing there soon for the latest. And we'll also today be hearing from a company that is looking to create a type of eBay for farmers. eBay for farmers. Is there money to be made? We'll find out soon. And if you need to get in touch with the Country Hour, our text is 0448 922 604. And a reminder that if you need to duck out in the paddock for whatever reason, you can always download our podcast later on this afternoon. First up today, small abattoirs in Western Australia. They claim they're being squeezed out of business by meat processors in the eastern states dumping large volumes of meat into WA. And as Ty Logan reports, if this keeps up, farmers could soon be feeling the pinch as well.
It's been described as a wall of cheap meat that's currently making its way into WA from the eastern states. It's been happening since March when the Aussie dollar started to rise. And the small Bunbury-based Dardanup Butchering Company claims it's now struggling to survive.
We've reduced our production across the three species, beef, lamb and pork. It's simply uneconomic to try and compete with that eastern states product that comes into WA. So yes, we've pulled those back and we're even looking to pull it back further this coming year. So, and I don't know what other processors are up to, but I think they'd be finding it as difficult as what we are.
Mark Panizza is the chief executive of the Small Meat Works and he says last year they scaled back production by 7%. And now things are so tight, he's going to have to decrease production by another 10%.
Normally, given our facilities and given the processing capacity we have, we tend to do much the same each year, but we just seem to be coming back in numbers each year recently.
What kind of prices are you competing with?
Oh, some of the sweeter cuts, we call them, your cube rolls, your rumps, your strip loins and things, they can be $6 to $8 to $10 a kilo cheaper than what we can produce that same product in our state for.
The Dardanup Butchering Company normally handles small quantities of high-end lamb, beef, pork and chicken, supplying about 6 to 8% of the West Australian market. Mark Panizza says the crazy thing is he's now buying more meat from the east just to stay competitive.
We do buy in products predominantly for the food service sector where it's very competitive price-wise. We operate in markets that our eastern states competitors operate in, so we have to match the prices that they tender, and the only way to do that is to use the same product that they use.
That's got to be, tricky for you as a West Australian local processor, having to then buy in eastern states produce just to compete. How does that feel?
Oh, well, it's no good when you're a local company employing local people. You'd like to be able to be processing that stock yourself, but a carcass of beef, for example, has 13 primal cuts, and if only four of those sell, then you're stuck with the other nine. What do you do with those? You have to discount them to get rid of them.
Mark Panizza says he believes the flood of cheaper product coming in from the eastern states is because of the rising Australian dollar, which is putting pressure on export markets.
The eastern states export two-thirds of what they produce and only consume one-third. West Australia, we're the reverse. We consume two-thirds and export one-third. So with the poor state of the export market, where does that other two-thirds go? And it tends to be dumped into Western Australia.
Meat and Livestock Australia's marketing manager Ben Thomas agrees, but he says that's not the only reason that WA processors would be competing with cheaper prices from the east.
on the back of what have been some very hot and dry conditions for winter, we're starting to see a lot of our producers lose confidence, and that's both on the lamb and cattle side of things. Many of those restockers that were in the market, paying extremely high prices for either feeder steers or restocker lambs, have started to lose a bit of confidence. And we're now all of a sudden starting to see the numbers come forward and on the market in higher numbers than what we've seen for the last 2 or 3 years. So all of a sudden you've got a compounding effect of one, more cattle on the market, and then two, a bit of resistance because of the stronger Aussie dollar. And if we have a look at what our retail beef prices have done, again, for the first time in a number of years, average retail prices, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, have actually eased slightly or declined, again, for the first time in a couple of years. So as a result, we've actually started to see per capita beef consumption increase slightly as well.
Ben Thomas says the offloading due to drought is similar in the lamb industry.
The big difference with lambs and sheep at the moment is we went through a strong phase of ewe retention being extremely high on the back of very strong wool prices and also on the back of very strong lamb prices. Now we've seen some widespread dry conditions, particularly in Victoria and southern New South Wales. Now looking forward, there is a bit of concern that if these dry conditions do continue and if there is a seasonally induced continuation and rise in the number of sheep and lambs on the market at the same time as there being the reduced processing capacity, either permanent or temporary, that could cause a bit more of a correction in the market than what otherwise would have been the case.
While the influx of meat from the east will affect all processors, it seems it's the small processors that will be the hardest hit. Cole McCrory is the chief executive of WAMCO, WA's biggest lamb processor. He says their big investments in international markets mean they can handle it.
We have, association with the three big New Zealand companies out of Alliance, Silver Fern and ANZCO in New Zealand that we co-brand with in the North American market. So these things take time, take a lot of money, take a lot of perseverance and a lot of hard work, but I think at the end of the day, the producers are seeing the results of that. And, you only have to look at our competitive schedule over the last few years, plus our rebates we've paid. The proof's in the pudding. We're delivering where we need to.
But Mark Panizza from DBC says if things don't turn around soon for them, it could get to the point where they don't process meat at all.
The meat business in this country is all about high volumes and low margins. So currently we have much diminished volumes and no margins. So it's not a good spot to be in. We may well do what everyone else does and just look for spot buys to put into our system to average back the prices we got to pay, or maybe we just don't process at all and just buy product in. It seems to just what's going on now is it's a lot cheaper to do that and try and run a meat business.
How much longer until those decisions have to be made?
That's a long way off. We're ticking over right at present, but we would like to go back to what we used to do with livestock numbers and support our local producers and not support the eastern states ones.
That's Dardanup Butchering Company Chief Executive Mark Panizza, and in that report from Tyne Logan. It is 13 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Matt Brand with you this afternoon. Well, Australia is facing an increasingly competitive grains market, and the challenges associated with that have dominated talks at one of the industry's biggest annual events. Around 850 people from 14 countries are in Melbourne right now for day two of the Australian Grains Industry Conference. Reporter Clint Jasper is there for the Country Hour. Clint, mate, we've been hearing all sorts of things about large world grain supplies and the prices not being too flash. Have you heard anything at this conference that indicates that situation might be changing?
That situation, Matt, is pretty much expected to stay the same over the coming season and probably beyond as well. So the headline figure that there's too much grain isn't changing. What people are starting to do now is drill down into the detail about where that grain actually is. And when you do that, you see lots of it's actually in China, a country which isn't about to actually export any grain, nor is it... And there's also big question marks over the quality of what's there. So what farmers and traders here were urged to look at the higher protein grains, the quality grains, which is where people are going to make money this year. One interesting stat 30 million tonnes less grain will be produced this harvest, according to estimates, but the amount exported will stay the same. So there'll be a big premium on higher protein wheat. And for those who have a crop kicking along, the canola price is expected to hold steady as well.
Right. Now, trade policy plays a big role in all of this. Any bright spots on the horizon for Aussie grain growers?
I think like every conference you go to now with agriculture, China was probably the most discussed market. There was a really interesting presentation talking about the fact that China has a whole suite of new food regulations and rules that they're very keen to tell not only their domestic producers but their import partners as well, that the rules are here, the standards are here. In many cases, they're higher than what we would see at home or international, and they will be enforced. Most recent example, the temporary beef ban for not labelling the product in the way that China wanted to. Yeah. Another example is the dramas we've seen with the infant milk formula. So China's very keen to promote the fact that it wants to be known for food safety, and it knows it's got a long way to go to do that. So China definitely a place that we can sell our grain, but like everything, they will be cracking down on the rules in the coming years.
Now, Donald Trump, he's in the headlines plenty, and I understand there's been a few mentions of him at the conference as well.
That's right. There's actually what I heard from a lot of people after this speech by Sarah Wyant, who is a basically runs a team of journalists in Washington, D.C. They run a subscription service that focuses exclusively on ag and food policy. In Australia, we're fed a steady diet of White House scandals, embarrassing gaffes, and some sprinkled sometimes with some predictions of doom and gloom for international trade. What we heard from Sarah was how farmers view their president in the United States. Now, President Trump's created lots of confusion on the international stage about Trump, and yet farmers and ranchers are some of his strongest supporters. So I asked her why that is.
Well, you're right that there has been a lot of uncertainty, especially over what's going to happen with trade. And because it amounts to about 20% of net farm income on average, some commodities much higher than that. But trade is very important to farmers, ranchers in the U.S., and so there's been uncertainty on that and on the immigration front on whether there's going to be enough access for farm workers. But in general, farmers and ranchers tell us that they're very pleased that this is a person who recognizes the struggles of a group of Americans who they think have been forgotten largely by much of Washington. They are the backbone of the American economy. They are producing our food supply. They are the timbermen. They are the coal miners. And all these different folks that help manage our natural resources see Trump as someone who wants to give them the freedom to operate, removing regulatory burdens, opening up new avenues for economic development, and basically touting the working man's values.
Men with big hats like yours, Matt.
Hey, just quickly, Clint, at the conference, any interesting talk about technology in the grains industry and any exciting popping up?
There was an announcement this morning. CBH is partnering with a startup called AgriDigital to trial something that's called blockchain. It's essentially a ledger system for accounting along the supply chain. You're about to hear much more about that on the show. But I guess the most exciting innovation comes up this afternoon when we all get to try Australia's first lentil beer.
Well, what? Yeah. Taste testing lentil beer.
Yeah, it's a South Australian invention, which might account for its weirdness, but I think everyone's pretty keen to try it. And there'll be a discussion about the craft beer market, which, as we know, is also booming along.
Tough gig. You okay?
I'm surviving.
Oh, excellent. Thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Cheers, good on you, Matt.
Cheers. That's Clint Jasper getting ready to wet the whistle there at a major grains conference being held in Melbourne, day two, in fact, of this Australian Grains Industry Conference. Lentil beer. How does that sound for you? on a Thursday afternoon. 19 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Let's learn more about what Clint was referring to there. Blockchain technology. The CBH Group's taking a look at this. It's going to trial blockchain by selling a few loads of oats out of Blue Lake Million in South Australia this month. CBH is teaming up with AgriDigital, a startup company which provides a digital platform to connect buyers and sellers of grain. But what is blockchain technology and how can it work for farmers? Emma Weston is the chief executive of AgriDigital. She says blockchain is a fairly simple concept and in grain trading, it gives security of payment. But it's also, she says, a way of demonstrating the origin of grain to a consumer.
Blockchain is just a technology which provides the ability to enter data into a database or a data store, but in a way that it can never be changed or edited or deleted. So it creates an immutable, unchangeable record of that data. And it does it in a way in which that data can be shared with all participants in a transaction or all participants in a network. So we have a transparency of that data according to the transactional transparency, so just shared between the participants of that transaction because of the way that that data can be shared across the network.
If we take that concept into buying and selling grain, Emma, how can this work?
For buyers and sellers of grain, the way that the blockchain is used is it's a new technology that effectively underpins the existing trading environment. So it's not going to change the way grain is bought or sold necessarily. Farmers will be doing the same thing that they've always done, growing, delivering in to their buyer, contracting maybe through their consultant, through a broker or doing that themselves. But one of the things that blockchain can do very well is give them a surety of both payment. And this is really important, not just for farmers, but for any seller through the supply chain. So one of the big gaps in our supply chain at the moment is settlement latency, or the time between when a commodity is delivered in through the system and when it's paid for, and the risk that is therefore borne by the seller whilst they're awaiting payment. Now, in a state like WA, with a company like CBH, that risk is probably very minimal, but that's not the same throughout the supply chain globally. The other thing is that for traders of grain, what a blockchain enables is auto-reconciliation of all of the balances of the commodities that have been traded. So all of these different databases that are out there that every trader has at the moment and they need to reconcile with each other to find out what their position is, that can be done automatically and in real time on a blockchain.
And essentially, is it a case of direct bank-to-bank communication? Is that how it takes the risk out? Because as a seller, you know that the buyer has the funds?
Yeah, so last year we did the world's first settlement of a physical agri-commodity. It was wheat on a blockchain. And just to explain how that worked, and maybe just giving an example just makes it a lot easier for the listeners, the farmer actually drove up to the weighbridge, delivered their grain, or it was weighed at the weighbridge. We knew the quality at the weighbridge, of course. There was already a pre-existing contract in place, so we knew what the value of that load is. What we were able to do with blockchain and with the smart contract, which is the coding technology that sits on top of a blockchain, is we were able to look into that buyer's bank balance, if you like, or into their digital wallet, and we could verify that that buyer had sufficient funds to be able to pay that grower and that that payment could be made as soon as that grower had made a physical delivery. And what the blockchain does and the technology that sits on top of a blockchain, which is called a smart contract, is it does all of that automatically. So there's no people involved in that anymore. That's all just technology and code that actually enables that. So once the farmer actually makes a physical delivery, the code recognises that delivery has taken place and is able to then say, okay, let's make a payment straight away to the grower. And so that can be done with a bank, but it can also be done without banks as well on a blockchain.
AgriDigital and CBH Group are going to work together on a pilot to use blockchain technology to sell oats at Blue Lake Milling. How will that system work, Emma?
It's very similar to what we've outlined, but one of the particular areas of focus of this pilot is what's been called provenance. So that's paddock to plate transparency. So we're looking at being able to track from farm all the way through Blue Lake Milling as the processor to the buyer of those oats and being able to prove that those oats not only come from a particular origin, come from a region or come from Australia, but also their organic status in this case. There's a growing demand for that level of proof, that level of veracity that sits behind the claims that have been made about our food. And blockchain is fantastic because of the way that we can post these data records onto this chain or this blockchain, and they can never be changed. It's a fantastic proof of all of the different data points as food is both grown, produced, transported and processed through our supply chain.
Is that a way of taking the story behind a product then directly to the market?
Absolutely. So at its, its ultimate, what we're really able to do eventually is empower consumers to make values-based or, informed purchasing decisions. They'll be able to effectively, either scan a code or click on a link to be able to look at the authentic food story that sits behind the food, or indeed the fibre it could be cotton or wool that they're actually purchasing.
So the pilot is going live at Blue Lake this month. How many tonnes of oats will you be selling through this system initially?
Yeah, so there'll just be a few loads that'll be going through next week. In total,
all organic, Emma, or...?
There'll be some organic, some non-organic. We've got a range of different deliveries that have been made from a range of different origins, and that's part of what we're testing as well. So not just doing a single origin point, but being able to track multi-origin. So we're looking at somewhere probably around about 100-150 tonnes at this stage. Ultimately, what we're really involved in at AgriDigital is digitising the whole agricultural supply chain. So we're interested in how blockchain and other digital technologies can be applied all the way from farmer through to the consumer, and that's what the potential is. It's really been able to link all participants in a supply chain through one platform, through one network.
Emma Weston from AgriDigital speaking there to Joe Prendergast. The Blue Lake trial that was mentioned there, that will begin next week. They're expecting to sell deliveries from a number of locations of both organic and non-organic oats. And they're expecting to sell about 150 tonnes from this trial. Tomorrow on the Rural Report in the southern grain regions, you'll be hearing from the CBH Group. Why is this something that it wants to trial? You'll find out tomorrow on the Rural Report, 6:15, the perfect way to start your day. 12:27, still on technology, a Melbourne startup company is tapping into the paddock-to-plate movement and is setting up a kind of eBay for farmers. Producers will be able to sell their products directly to consumers through this online platform. And initially, this will all happen in Victoria, New South Wales and South Australia. The company is called MegaFresh, and it's invested in new technology that will test the produce for freshness and quality so that, ideally, consumers will know exactly what they're buying. Jess Davis has more.
Online shopping is about to get a new player on the scene, an online market for fresh fruit and veggies.
The model works the same as eBay or Amazon. The farmer or the seller will list their products. We then provide the platform and the fulfillment service. We charge a commission on whatever the price of the retail price that the farmer sets for the product.
Founder of MegaFresh, Alex Stefan, says it will provide a connection between consumers and farmers.
They know where their food's coming from, and they're supporting their farmers directly. And rather than giving a percentage of the cost of the product to a large supermarket, that money is going back to the farmer.
The platform is still in its infancy and in the process of looking for farmers to sign up. Yarra Valley apple producer Kevin Sanders is one farmer who's happy to be a guinea pig for the startup.
I think this is going back to one of the things that the public used to have. They used to know their grower on a very regular basis, and that connection between people and their food is a really growing thing out there in for the consumers. They feel much more comfortable with where they buy if they can understand who the grower is, and they can talk to their grower on a regular basis, through social media, and I think it'll be a fabulous thing for them.
Alex Stefan says given modern technology, farmers no longer need retailers to sell their products.
I do feel that the farmers and manufacturers have been mistreated by the large corporates. Personally, I want to help farmers and manufacturers access consumers directly. I don't think it's necessary that they have to use retailers and consumers anymore. All the farmers that I've spoken to so far are really keen on the idea.
There's one catch. Most people are wary of buying fresh produce online, but Alex Stefan has a way around that. He's invested in new technology that measures the freshness and quality of fruit and veggies.
All fresh produce is actually going to be tested by us. When you buy fresh produce online, it's quite difficult to know what the quality is like. Most people want to handle the fruit. You know, for instance, the avocado, is it firm? Is it soft? Is it overripe? So we're actually providing a testing service where all fresh produce is tested and the results are actually available on the listing. The test will show the aroma intensity, the flavour intensity, the nutritional profile and the level of ripeness. So that's something that you can't even get from any other supermarket.
That technology has been developed in Israel and Alex believes they'll be one of the first places in Australia to use it.
So we can hold up any fruit or a strawberry, an apple under the machine. It'll take a light sample. It uses light, beams of light to measure the level of sugars and the levels of various nutrients in the fruit.
Apple grower Kevin Sanders says the instant feedback on quality and communication with customers will help him expand his business.
I think that over time it could transfer into quite a much bigger market for ourselves. It might enable us opportunities to grow different varieties that are not very mainstream or introduce people to new varieties because you need the constant communication from your customers about what's good about your variety and what's bad about it. I mean, you need to understand what the consumer wants.
Founder Alex Stefan says to make the site viable, he'll need around 200 producers to sign up. But at the moment, more buyers are signing up than sellers.
It's early days, and so we're currently in the process of signing up farmers and sellers. The sooner we can do that, the sooner the platform will you know, make money for farmers and become a popular destination on the internet.
That's Alex Stefan. He's the founder of MegaFresh, and in that report by Jess Davis. It's gone past 12:30 here on the Country Hour. Let's get the news headlines now with Rebecca Dollery. Beck?
Thanks, Matt. The WA Premier has backed away from his scathing assessment of the Prime Minister's week-long visit to the state, but says he's still disappointed with the outcome. Mark McGowan yesterday described Malcolm Turnbull's trip a waste of time in comments the Prime Minister labelled belligerent. The pair then met for more than an hour and a half last night for discussions Mr McGowan says were productive, but did not resolve WA's GST complaints. Airport security set to return to normal levels after security agents agencies determined there's no longer a threat to the country's aviation industry. Last week, police said they'd uncovered a plot to bring down a plane, prompting the government to impose tighter security and screening at the nation's airports. And an Australian nurse will spend a year in a Cambodian prison after being found guilty of acting as an intermediary between an adoptive parent and a pregnant woman and fraudulently obtaining documents. Tammy Davis-Charles has been sentenced to 18 months imprisonment and fined $1,200. She's already spent 9 months in pre-trial detention. Thanks, Matt. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, that Beck. And tell me, lentil beer, yay or nay?
I'm sorry, Matt, I didn't catch that, which was...
Lentil beer.
Lentil beer.
Yay or nay?
That's going to be a nay from
a
me.
A nay from Rebecca Dollery. Okay, okay. Not even curious?
Oh, look, I'd try anything, yeah, but yep. Lentils.
All right. I'll know what to bring to your birthday party next. Good on you. Have a good one.
Thanks.
That's Rebecca Dollery in the newsroom and not too keen on lentil beer. We heard about it in the first half of the Country Hour. Do you like the idea of that? Sitting back this afternoon, Thursday, having a lentil beer?
Hi there. My name's Melissa Bruton and I'm a wildlife ecologist for the Australian Wildlife Conservancy. In my hands here, we've got a cute little binose gecko, which we caught at one of these sites, and I'm just going to go and let him go. You're listening to the Country Hour.
You are listening to The Country Hour right across WA. Matt Brand with you this afternoon. You can always tune into The Country Hour via the internet or maybe download a podcast at a time that suits you. That's cool. Hey, still to come on today's program, we'll be taking a look at the Ord Irrigation Scheme. There was a report out on it last week about the economics of the scheme. You might have seen it. You might have read it. You might have seen the headlines of the Ord being a waste of money. People in Kununurra are feeling pretty undervalued by that report. We'll be taking a close look at it very soon. Stick around. James Ashley is at the Weather Bureau this afternoon. How are you, James?
Oh, I'm good, thanks, Matt. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not too bad, thanks, matey. Lentil beer, yay or nay?
I've got to go yay.
I like a dal.
Combine the two. You've got to be onto a winner.
I'm intrigued to know what it tastes like. I guess once you start chucking in a few other flavours, it could. You could be drinking anything. But it's a yay from James. I like it, mate. Weather-wise, away from the beers, Southwest Land Division, how are things looking?
There's not a great deal around, really. A bit of a break between the good front we had sort of Monday, Tuesday, and we've got a cold front moving through the southwest today. It's pushed up, it's almost to Mandurah now, and it's sort of moving across the Bremer Bay type area along the south coast. It's not very strong, so it's producing some showers and about 3 to 5 millimetres of rain as it moves through. And that'll get showers right through the Southwest Land Division, although it weakens as it does go north and east, maybe even pushing up into the sort of far southern parts of the Gascoyne, southern goldfields as well tonight.
When you say showers, how many millimetres potentially?
Well, through the lower west, southwest, along the south coast, it's probably 5 millimetres. But once you get inland and in the northeastern parts of the Southwest Land Division, it's probably less than a millimetre. It's a pretty weak feature. And it clears up behind it, so showers will really contract just back to the southwest coast later today as that front moves eastwards. And as a high-pressure system starts moving in, it'll be pretty cold overnight, so we're expecting another area of frost through inland parts of the Southwest Land Division for early tomorrow morning. And showers for tomorrow, the remnants of the front will probably still be producing a few showers early in the day around the Kalbarri-Geraldton area, but they'll clear up by sunrise. And then it's really south of a line, or southwest of a line from about Durian Bay to Albany and along the south coast where we'll see showers for tomorrow. Only light falls away from the south coast. Another front does brush the south coast Friday night into Saturday morning, and that'll increase showers around that sort of, Walpole to Esperance type area overnight Friday, early Saturday before easing off again. So there's a little bit more along the south coast, but remaining just light falls in the lower west and most of the southwest districts. Through Saturday, so those showers, again, just that southwest corner along the south coast, nothing into the agricultural areas for Saturday as that high pressure system sort of parks itself over the central wheat belt. And a similar story for Sunday, only light falls in the lower west and some showers along the south coast, which will clear. There is another system sort of approaching late Sunday, so showers will increase along that far southwest coast, that area between Cape Naturalist and Walpole, late on Sunday, and produce probably some moderate falls during the course of Monday, around 10 to 20 millimetres through that, anywhere from Bunbury around to Walpole during Monday, with showers getting as far north as Perth and as far inland as sort of Katanning and through Albany. So just that southwest corner on Monday. And bonus weather for middle of next week, it's potential, something to keep your eye out for a decent rain system coming through the middle of next week.
All right. Ooh.
Bit of a teaser there for you.
Yeah, I love your work. I presume not too much to tell us about the north.
No.
It's a bit blowy. Mm.
Yeah, it was pretty windy this morning right across the northern half of the state. That's probably it for the winds. They'll ease off from now on. It has brought up a lot of cold air. So cold night right through the northern half of the state tonight and remaining pretty cool for the next couple of nights as those winds ease off. But no weather around.
I think it's going to be about pretty much bang on 30 degrees in Broome this afternoon for the Prime Minister. That's good conditions on Cable Beach.
Yeah.
With a lentil beer.
Go, doesn't he?
Yeah. Good stuff. All right. Thanks so much for that, James. I presume, no other warnings we need to be aware of.
Just coastal waters just warnings, mainly for the south coast.
Gotcha. Thanks so much.
Cheers, Matt.
That is James Ashley at the Weather Bureau. As he mentioned, there has been the odd shower and some rain gauges have recorded a bit. Richard Hudson joins us now. G'day, Richard.
Yeah, not too much to report, unfortunately, particularly for those regions that really do need it. But in the north and eastern districts, nothing reported at all. In the Eucla, a tiny bit of rain, but nothing over 3 mils. Nothing out on the islands. In the central west, nothing beyond Dew. In the lower west, nothing over 3 mils. In the southwest, there's just Walpole Forestry had 7 and Windy Harbour 5 mils. In the southern coastal region, I think the most is about 2, but that's over 2 days. Even in Albany, they're not getting much rain. In the central wheat belt, again, nothing more than Dew. And in the great southern region, there was nothing past 2 millimetres at Woodnilling, and that's it, unfortunately. But we have had a text, Matt, from one of our regular correspondents, Les from Gero. Mm-hmm. He says, magic mushy meal washed down with lentil beer. The mung beans will go right off.
Les, what about for you? Hutto, lentil beer, yay or nay?
I try all of them. I leave my options open and I'm very open-minded when it comes to alcohol.
Very nice. All right. Well, thank you very much for that.
Pleasure.
Richard Hudson there with the rainfall figures from the past 24 hours to 9 a.m. this morning. Yeah, the Prime Minister on a plane right now, is my understanding, landing in Broome at about 1 o'clock. If he is listening to the Country Hour, little tip for the Prime Minister, you've got the Kununurra Rodeo Camp Draft starting tomorrow. Goes for 3 days. There's a little tip for you, PM. It is 20 minutes to 1 here on the Country Hour. Now, there was an economic assessment of the Kimberley's Ord Irrigation Scheme released on Friday, and it was pretty scathing. You might have read it, or at the very least, seen headlines such as Ord Scheme, a $2 billion waste. The report by the Australia Institute, which was paid for by an environmental group, it claimed that more than $2 billion had been spent on the Ord since 1959, of which more than $1.5 billion of it was public money. Now, the report concluded that the scheme had delivered little return and was a lesson in what not to do in Northern Australia. Now, we'll be hearing from the report's author, Rod Campbell, in just a moment. But first, let's hear from Francis Bright. He's an agricultural economist who's worked in Northern Australia for the last 15 years. He's taken a close look at the Oz Institute's report, and he believes it's got some major issues.
It looks easy to read, but there's a paucity of detail. It's picked out various facts without looking at all the facts that are available. I'm a bit disappointed that there has been no efforts made to obtain the value of production out of the Ord since 88. That's not included. In terms of primary data sources, I can't see any acknowledgement or recognition of people that they actually spoke to in the East Kimberley. Where is the ABARES data? Where is the Department of Agriculture's data on the production that actually has come out of the Ord? In terms of the benefits of the Ord, what's in, what's out? Are you only looking at the benefits that accrue directly from agricultural production, or are you looking at the benefits of having the Ord Irrigation Scheme and the town of Kununurra as a hub that contributes significantly to the whole regional economy of the East Kimberley?
The figure of more than $1.5 billion of taxpayer money spent on the Ord since 1959, from what you've read and what you know, is that figure spot on?
Well, one of the interesting things is, are we talking about 1959 dollars or are we talking about 2016 dollars?
Well, we're talking about 2016 dollars, apparently. The report says it updated the figures to 2016 dollars, so it could be more easily compared. Is that normal for a research report?
You can do it, but over that sort of time frame, there are problems. Using a cost-benefit framework to compound stuff from the early 1960s into 2016 dollars, that's a really long time frame. cost-benefit analysis normally has a time frame of 10 to 20 years. They're squeezing this out to 50 or 60 years. And the other thing that is really an omission in this particular report is what was their compounding rate? What were they multiplying by to get to $2016? And is that reasonable? So I'd be happy to sit down and have a look at the calculations, but there's just nothing in the report that demonstrates to me where these numbers come from. And that's a problem.
This report doesn't put a value on other outcomes of damming the audit. It doesn't put a value on the tourism, the Ramsar wetlands, the hydropower, the entire town of Kununurra. Is that fair enough for a research report like this, or is that an oversight?
I think it's a big oversight, because there's a lot in Kununurra that's come as a result of the audit. It doesn't look at the benefits of tourism. It doesn't look at the benefits of being an administrative hub. The presence of Kimberley TAFE, the presence of a whole raft of the regional economy that's not just agriculture. So, yeah, I look, leaving all the values out, it's not good into economics. Because it seems more like you're concentrating only on one very specific part of gross regional product and saying it doesn't stack up given the money that's been spent on it. Well, without the AWD scheme, there wouldn't be the town side of Kununurra.
That's Francis Bright. He's an agricultural economist speaking about a report called Damn the Expense, which was put together by the Canberra-based Australia Institute. The report's author is Rod Campbell. I asked him why the report did not put a value on other benefits of the AWD, such as tourism and the town of Kununurra. This is what he had to say.
Yeah, that's a good question. So our study is largely a compilation of other studies, and some of those have been commissioned by federal and state governments. And so none of those things have been highlighted before. And you're absolutely right. They should be considered. I'm a little bit surprised that the WA Auditor General didn't look into some of those impacts. And things like that should be considered in an economic assessment of an investment.
So how come you didn't look at it?
So nobody else has. And,
you were asked to do an economic assessment on the audit irrigation scheme.
Mm.
No one else has done it, but isn't that your opportunity? I'm trying to get a sense of why it seems the report ignores those values.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, ours is an exercise in secondary sources, and it's interesting that none of those earlier sources looked at things like impacts on downstream fisheries either. So I think it's a valid point, and I think it'd be great if there was more consideration of that.
Commercial fishing on Lake Argyle, for example, not included. Why is that?
So commercial fishing on Lake Argyle, I'd have to go back to some of those mid-90s studies which I don't have on me to see whether or not they included some of those impacts.
Okay, that's all right. Who from Kununurra during this research project? Who from Kununurra did you approach?
So we didn't speak to anyone in Kununurra ourselves. We looked heavily at the WA Auditor General's report and obviously census data that covers that area.
How come there's no reference to the annual production summaries and the accumulated value of ag production from the AWD from its beginnings?
So, from the beginnings,
yeah.
A lot of that data is really hard to get. And to get the data we used involved actually having to get hold of physical copies of documents at the National Library. So a lot of that data is really hard to get, and it'd be great if it was more easily accessible for researchers and policymakers to be able to get it in one place and make better assessments.
Does that then damage the credibility of your conclusions?
No, not at all. Because when the data's not there and not being made publicly available, you know, it's also very difficult to get data on what public subsidies are going into the maintenance of all that infrastructure. And there's no doubt that they're there. So, you know, I think it'd be great to have a lot more detailed information. But this is not a new conclusion. I mean, economists have been concerned about the AUD as an investment since it was first proposed.
It's Rod Campbell from the Australia Institute, author of Damn the Expense, an economic assessment of the AUD irrigation scheme, which was released last week and caused plenty of headlines. The report, it was paid for by Environs Kimberley, which is an organisation based in Broome. The director there, Martin Pritchard, would not disclose how much money it paid to the Oz Institute, and he says that's irrelevant. I asked why Environs Kimberley wanted this research done now.
Well, what we've got at the moment is this massive push for agriculture across northern Australia through things like developing the North White Paper. And if there is going to be a push for development in northern Australia, we believe that most people in the community would like to see what the costs and the benefits are. And so when you take a look at something like the AUD and the amount of taxpayer funding that's gone into it, we think it's really important that it's transparent about what actually came out of it in terms of a return on investment. And we wanted to make sure that government was really aware of what this kind of investment means in the north, so that a choice can be made between doing something like this or perhaps something that is of a bit more value.
The report doesn't put a value on other benefits of damming the river, such as the tourism, the Ramsar wetlands, hydropower, and the entire town of Kununurra. Do you feel that's a major oversight?
Oh, look, what we were wanting to look at was the agricultural issue. And sure, there's been some side benefits, but I mean, obviously, the main purpose of the dam was to create agricultural areas. And if we're going to look at it in terms of public investment, well, let's have a proper look at it and see what it has actually produced. So, there's a serious concern about the AUD and the way it's going. So, you know, let's have a look and actually see.
For those who perceive this as paying for research to suit, what would you say to them?
We've done the research. People can have a look at it. If they want to knock it, that's fine, but the numbers speak for themselves.
That's Director of Environs Kimberley, Martin Pritchard. We've got more on this story up online right now. If you go searching for WA Country Hour, it's got further analysis of this report, Damn the Expense. It's a long read, but I hope you'll take some time to check it out. So that's up online. If you just go searching for WA Country Hour. It is 8 minutes to one. Just quickly, future's looking pretty good if you're in the business of iron ore, especially if you listen to Rio Tinto. The company announced an underlying profit of $3.9 billion for the first half of the year. That's just for the first half. And that figure is up more than $2 billion US from this time last year. And looking ahead, Rio's chief executive, Jean-Sébastien Jacques, says the company is pretty confident about China. That's a direct quote. Pretty confident about China and the strength of its economy. So confident, in fact, that Rio has announced its biggest shareholder dividend ever at a 110 cents US a share. Now, that's more than double last year's dividend. Mr. Jacques says 2017 will be a good year for China, and the early signs for 2018 and 2019 are also looking good. The price of iron ore doing pretty well, sitting at $72.3 a ton. Good time to be in iron ore. Rio printing a few dollars. Well, an environmental approval for a 3,000-hectare aquaculture zone at the Abrolhos Islands off the Geraldton coast has just been approved by the state government. It'll be the second large-scale aquaculture zone in the state. The other one's in the Kimberley. And this announcement follows the successful development of a yellowtail farm off the Geraldton coast. Floating sea cages will be used to grow marine finfish, which naturally occur in the Midwest region under what the government has described as strict environmental conditions. Fisheries Minister Dave Kelly says the zone will create up to 1,400 jobs and will be formally opened next month.
This aquaculture development zone has been earmarked for finfish that already naturally occur in that region. We're expecting people obviously to be using floating sea cages. Now, we're not going to dictate to people exactly how it's done and what the species are, but this zone in particular is earmarked for finfish. So, there's already at least one operator in the area, and we are inviting other operators to come forward. And we've had some significant interest from existing operators here in Australia, and we're hoping that they'll take up this opportunity in the Midwest.
That's the Fisheries Minister, Dave Kelly. So just repeating that news, environmental approval for a 3,000-hectare aquaculture zone at the Abrolhos Islands.
Join us for The World Today.
Hello, I'm Eleanor Hall. On the program today, the New South Wales anti-corruption watchdog issues damning findings against three former state Labor ministers, including the disgraced Eddie Obeid. Donald Trump reveals he has a new immigration plan and it's based on the Australian system. And could a mobile phone app help Muslim parents prevent their children from becoming radicalised?
Shows them, you know, what is the internet, what is social media, what are the websites and apps, what do they do, what are the dangers of grooming, recruitment, but more importantly, what are some of the practical tips? Do you have any rules about time spent online? What is online speech? And that's the most popular.
More than the headlines, The World Today.
On the line is Annabelle Coppen from Yarri Station. She's given us a call. How are you, Annabelle?
Very well, Matt. You?
I am well. I presume you're busy getting ready for the Pilbara Livestock Handling Cup.
We are. It's been quite a chaotic week, and it's only going to get busier, but we're very excited about kicking off tomorrow.
Yeah. Give us the quick 101 on what it is.
Oh, it's basically, it's the second cup now. Matt, we kicked it off last year with the idea about bringing station teams together and learning and sharing a bit of pride in your stockmanship and how you handle your cattle, and also looking into improving the welfare for the cattle on farm as well.
Nothing like it in the world, you reckon?
I would argue that. Yep. I don't think there's that many competitions where you bring people together and promote stockmanship and be judged on how you handle those cattle and how good your skills are.
Hey, I've got to go here, Annabelle, but all the best with it and might touch base later on, hey?
That'd be great.
Thanks for getting in touch. Yeah, good. Yeah, lovely. Annabelle Coppen, there you go, getting ready for the Pilbara Livestock Handling Cup. Speaking of cattle, sales are on at Mount Barker today, 420 heads sold. Tracy Kilner has the details.
It has officially been confirmed that your stock are in the best hands, with Mount Barker Sale Yards being presented the National Award in Animal Welfare in Sale Yards and Lairages at the Rockhampton Conference last week. Congratulations to the Mount Barker team. Numbers were down this week for a small yarding of 336 mixed quality cattle. The yarding was dominated by young cattle, with the lightweight weaner steers selling to a top of 382 cents a kilo. Bullocks, 600 to 750 kilos, sold for 218 to 250 cents. Grown steers weighing 500 to 600 kilos made 234 to 248 cents. And the lighter 400 to 500 kilo steers sold for 220 to 296 cents. Grown heifers over 540 kilos made 200 to 212 cents a kilo. The heavy yearling steers sold for 230 to 314 cents, and heavy yearling heifers eased, making 178 to 220 cents a kilo. Weaner steers over 280 to 330 kilos sold from 300 to 338 cents. Lighter steers weighing under 280 kilos gained 5 cents, selling for 330 to 382 cents, averaging 354 cents a kilo. The weaner heifers over 330 kilos sold for 236 cents, while the 280 to 330 kilo heifers made 262 to 272 cents. Lightweights under 280 kilos sold for 254 to 280 cents a kilo. Heavy prime cows eased 9 cents, making 170 to 196 cents, averaging 186 cents a kilo. and store cows fell 37 cents, selling for 144 to 160 cents. Heavy bulls were down 13 cents, selling from 170 to 196 cents, and lightweight bulls sold from 226 to 324, depending on their weight and quality. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you for that, Tracy. That's all we've got time for on the Country Hour today. A reminder that if you want to read more about that analysis of the Ord report, you can check it out online if you go in and type WA Country Hour. And yes, whether you're the Prime Minister of the country or just travelling around WA, the Kununurra Radio and Camp Draft, it kicks off tomorrow. You should go and check it out. Have a nice Thursday afternoon. Enjoy the lentil beers. And remember, keep it rural.